Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Governor Mike DeWine has delayed execution dates again for two death row inmates as the state continues to search for a pharmaceutical company willing to sell the drugs to use for capital punishment. It's the first time in 3 years Ohio will not hold any executions in a calendar year. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Andy Chow, Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau reporter, joins us. Welcome.
Good morning.
Jesse Ballmert, state government reporter for the Cincinnati Enquirer. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And Jeremy Pelzer, politics reporter for Cleveland.com. Welcome.
Hi, thanks so much.
Okay, so Ohio cannot get these drugs. The governor is delaying the executions again. I heard a report where he said any time in this year will there be, and he said he seriously doubted it. What is the equation here, Andy Chow? At what point do they give up?
Well, I think that's sort of the line that the state and in particular Governor Mike DeWine's administration is walking right now, where, I mean, they've come up to the point where they could just say, listen, we just don't have the process or the procedure in place to carry an execution. So from this day forward, unless we figure out a different procedure, we're not going to have executions. They haven't said quite that, but that's basically where Ohio is right now when it comes to having a hard time finding the drugs that they would need to carry out an execution. DeWine has said many times that part of the problem is that there are pharmaceutical companies that do not want to give over these drugs.
Right.
Because
that's
they don't
a well-known
want the
fact. It kind of goes against their ethical.
And so I guess the question
mission.
Is, does the state sort of use this as an excuse to not carry out executions? Because there's plenty of politicians who don't want to carry out the death penalty anyway, and may not want to say that out loud. So they could just use this as an excuse. So right now we're sort of in this limbo where we're not really sure where the state's going to go at this point.
What does that mean for the people on death row, Jeremy Pelzer?
It means they're going to keep waiting. Mm-hmm. It means they're going to keep waiting. And how many death row? There's dozens of inmates on death row through 2024, and they're just going to keep waiting. This latest round of reprieves delays, one of the guys, he had already had his execution pushed back another time earlier this year.
Right, right, right.
And so it's just going to keep waiting and waiting in this holding pattern. I mean, the governor's in a real, and lawmakers too, they're in a real pickle here, because it's not just that pharmaceutical companies are unwilling to sell these drugs. It's that if the state buys these drugs and the pharmaceutical companies find that they've sold it, they're going to refuse to sell any drugs to the state. So that means Medicaid, state employees. So it's pretty high stakes. And so the governor is in a real bind. That's why he said earlier this year we should look at different execution methods. We should, he's trying to find any way to make this happen.
Mm-hmm. What are the options, Jesse Ballmert, that they've kind of eliminated all the options, haven't they?
Yeah, so you can look to what other states have done. Some other governors have put a moratorium on the death penalty because they can't find medication or because of the expense or because of, concerns about people being executed who, now DNA shows did not deserve to be.
They weren't the guilty party.
They weren't the guilty party. So that's one method. Other states have gone the opposite direction and opened up different methods for executing people, going back to the electric chair or to even offering, I think, the firing range as an option. So there's a lot of different ways you can go on this. I think the method Ohio is doing, this kind of slow rolling back, kind of delay on the death penalty, is the easier route for lawmakers to take right now.
To do nothing.
To allow the governor to keep pushing it back. The alternative is going through legislation and making some sort of change. And I always point to this piece of legislation that there's a bill that would prevent those with severe mental illness diagnoses from being subject to the death penalty. And that piece of legislation can't really get through the legislature. So if we can't pass something that stops the execution of those with severe mental illness, I don't think we're going to pass something that completely eliminates the death penalty in Ohio.
There's not the stomach. But in some conservative Republican-leaning states, Wyoming, and others, they are looking at ending the death penalty, Andy Chow. So, but not an appetite for it here.
Not an appetite for it here. And there have been more and more conservative policy think tanks, conservative voices out there who are saying that it's not really a good way to go economically as well.
It's expensive.
It's expensive to carry this out. And so might as well just let these people serve life in prison for their crimes. But again, there are still even people in the legislature that do want to see executions carried out and who have been proposing ideas. There's a bill out there that I think would take it's a proposal to take confiscated fentanyl and use that as a way to carry out the death penalty.
But the governor's kind of went, yeah, no.
Right.
That's and, not and a I, serious, it's yeah. not, very it's, serious
it's,
proposal.
Yeah, you know, House Speaker Larry Householder says that it's not a route that he would want to go to either. But I mean, this has been something that's been discussed for years because of the issues that we've had with the mix of drugs used for an execution. Even back 3 or 4 years ago, when Keith Faber, Republican senator, was the Senate president at the time, he said it was something that we needed to look into, where everything should be on the table. So what should the state do to carry out an execution? Should they bring back the electric chair? Should they use a different cocktail of drugs? It all comes down, just like what Jesse said, it all comes down to how many legislators out there are really just, you know, really wanting to push forward with something, really excited about it. I don't think there's a lot of energy out there for it.
Well, but it's more than that. It needs to be a system that'll be ruled constitutional by the courts.
Right.
And that's – you can't just say, oh, we're going to, you know, throw someone off a bridge or something. You have to actually have something that will pass constitutional muster against cruel and unusual punishment.
We're in this position now because of a federal opinion that was released that said that what Ohio is doing now could be considered cruel and unusual.
Is there any state? I think Texas is moving forward with executions.
There are states that are going forward with executions, and I believe there are states that are able to either find the drug that they need or have been using a process to which a federal judge has not issued an opinion against it. But this is what Ohio's facing.
Have any defense lawyers representing death row inmates, have they raised any concerns, or civil rights lawyers, I should say, about their civil rights and being left in limbo like this?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that they also have a right to a speedy trial. I mean, not a trial, but they're arguing that they're just kind of leaving
them hanging.
Them hanging, or no pun intended. But they just have they've been filing this, but then it's making its way through the courts. So the ruling that Andy talked about, it got appealed to the appeals court, and the appeals court upheld it, and then it goes to this. You know, these things take a long time to make it through.
And so you try to put yourself in the position of the death row inmate or the people representing the death row inmate and the families of the victims. All these people are sort of waiting for something that keeps getting pushed and keeps getting pushed. And the fact that it's in limbo, the fact that a person's life and whether that person will still be alive in a month, I think weighs heavily on a lot of people. And when you talk to advocates for victims' families, they say that this takes a really big toll on them as well. There are families out there who see execution as a form of closure, and so they're waiting for that. There are other families who are on the reverse end who don't want to see that inmate be put to death, and so they have to go through a lot of mental challenges as well.
Meanwhile, back at the ranch, people are being convicted of capital crimes, to wit, the guy who killed the two Westerville police officers. They'll be eligible for the death penalty. They haven't gotten to that phase of it yet, but
I believe that starts today.
Okay.
Yeah, and honestly, I mean, you read some of the offenses that these people are convicted of, and they are truly horrific crimes. I mean, the Westerville police officer shooting is certainly among them, but I mean, these are really horrible situations where sometimes there was like sexual abuse before or after these deaths. So they're really, I can't imagine the victims' families waiting and constantly every time these things are delayed, that's one more time these details are drugged up, you know, throughout the state and newspapers too. So it's a rough process and something we don't really have a solution to. But on the legal side also, the appeals court actually said that the method that the earlier court was concerned about, this use of midazolam as one of the drugs that causes this kind of waterboarding effect, which is what the original judge said. The appeals court basically said that was fine. Like, that was something that we could be doing in Ohio. So even just what passes constitutional muster, changes from court to appeals court to Supreme Court. So it's a messy process here in Ohio.
Like, something's got to give here. This can't go on indefinitely. No one wants it to go on indefinitely. But it's a question of how long will it go on before there's the political will to make some change.
Do one thing or another.
And it's not a very popular issue to want to change. No one wants to spend political capital on, you know, altering or getting rid of the death penalty if you're pro-death penalty. Mm-hmm. But something's got to give here.
Anytime we talk about this form of limbo that the state's in when it comes to the death sentence, it reminds me of floor speech that Representative Dan Ramos, former representative from the Lorain area, gave about 4 years ago when the state, again, was still dealing with this kind of topic. And he said that when he's had private conversations with people, he gets the understanding that there's not a lot of legislators out there who actually want to support the death penalty. And so he's basically saying, why not just use this as an excuse to let it taper off and allow Ohio to just not carry out executions
anymore. Except that then these inmates remain in limbo.
And that's where I think what Jesse mentioned earlier, where the governor or the legislature can move for a moratorium. And that's been something that's been in play in the legislature in the past. It's been presented almost every session of the legislature to just call for a moratorium on this, and then
not abolishing it, but just pulling back.
Right. And then that sends a clear message to death row inmates that for the time being, unless another piece of legislation is passed, that they will not be executed.
They did that in Illinois before they abolished it.
Correct.
For quite a long time, I think.
Yeah.
We will continue our conversation. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. The Jeremy Pelzer of Cleveland.com, a politics reporter, is with us. Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Also, Jesse Ballmert of the Cincinnati Enquirer. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
StoryCorps shares unscripted conversations between two people about important things in life: love, loss, family, friendship. StoryCorps partnered with WOSU Public Media to record and share the stories of our city. Recorded here, StoryCorps Columbus preserves pieces of our shared history for future generations. Subscribe to the StoryCorps Columbus podcast now at WOSU.org/StoryCorps, on the WOSU mobile app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, Andy Chow. News Bureau reporter, Andy Chow. Cincinnati Enquirer State Government reporter, Jesse Ballmert. And Cleveland.com politics reporter, Jeremy Pelzer. Let's talk about House Bill 6.
Sure.
What's happening with that? This is the week that was now. What's the latest, Andy Cho?
So just to bring people up to speed, there was a referendum out there. You probably got the mailers. So we're talking about what a lot of people know to be the nuclear power plant bailout. The group that wanted to put a referendum on the bill did not collect enough signatures. They asked for an extension through the federal court. Federal court said no, but maybe the Ohio Supreme Court wants to decide on it. So it was sent to the Ohio Supreme Court. And that's where we are right now. The Ohio Supreme Court has asked all parties to file their briefs and file their arguments for whether this referendum group should have more time to continue to collect signatures. And that deadline is tomorrow, so we'll see. This is basically the last chance for Ohioans against corporate bailouts to hold a referendum on HB 6. But in the meantime, because the signatures were not turned in and not enough signatures were collected, HB 6 is now law. It's already gone into effect. And so the wheels are already spinning for subsidies to roll into nuclear power plants by 2021, subsidies for coal plants to be implemented. So there's a lot of moving parts that have begun because HB 6 is now in effect.
I mean, this is a Hail Mary play. Yeah. Like, even if it's going to take weeks to get something on this if they accept it. And even if, best case scenario, the anti HB6 folks get a favorable ruling, they're going to have to start collecting petition signatures in like January or February, which is not optimal petition gathering time outside in Ohio. So it's a long shot. Then there's just so many hoops and they have to nail every one of these hoops. It's going to be really hard.
Yeah. And the question that the Ohio Supreme Court has the option to look at is there were these 90 days for the bill to take effect, and that was the time that they had to collect the signatures that they needed to make the ballot. And as Andy said, they were short. The Ohioans Against Corporate Bailouts was saying that they were delayed by needing to submit the petition language to the attorney general and make sure that was fair and accurate. They also were submitting these forms to the Ohio Secretary of State's office with information about everybody collecting signatures that they were doing out of abundance of caution because of another petition that had been thrown out because of some problems. And so basically they're saying they lost like 38 days through all of this process. And if they had had those days, they would have been able to collect the number of signatures they needed. They were also facing a lot of opposition, as you were all aware. There were advertisements on television and mailers about how, you know, signing a petition was going to give your personal information to the Chinese government.
And then there were the blockers.
There were blockers. There was another petition that was being circulated to prevent foreign investment in utilities that people were paying more per signature to collect those signatures for a petition that really didn't have any binding legal status.
It just confused people. Or at least that's what they're suggesting.
Yeah, they would say that it was confusing
people. No question.
So I'm not sure if those 38 days would have made a difference. They were quite short on their raw number, but that's what they're trying for.
They believe, I think the legal term is prima facie, which they believe that they could have gotten the raw amount of signatures they needed in order to put a hold on the bill. It would not have actually been the right amount of valid signatures, but enough raw signatures to put it on hold. I mean, there's a lot of science and math to what these signature gatherers take into account. And so I believe the person who was running the show as far as the signature gatherers go said that he took into account that he was going to have 75 days to do everything, thinking that the attorney general and the secretary of state will approve the language by a certain time, and then he would have 75 days. The group had 52 days. So that's the big legal argument. That's the big what you write down on a brief to the Ohio Supreme Court. But the underlying argument is, and what you said, the blockers that were out there, the millions and millions of dollars that poured into the opposition to this ballot initiative.
And then there's another question whether or not it's a tax or a fee that HB6 creates when they charge utility ratepayers, what is it, $1.85 or whatever that amount is. Is it a tax or a fee? Now, the pro HB6 organizations called it a fee. Mm-hmm. They particularly didn't call it a tax because, you know, who wants to call something a tax? But now they're saying it is a tax.
Oh, it's definitely a tax.
And
yep.
Because
now,
if it's a tax, then the petition, is null and void on its face.
Yeah, this was an argument that the First Energy Solutions, which owns the two nuclear plants up in northern Ohio, was making before the Ohio Supreme Court, just another effort to kind of block this referendum effort. And yeah, their argument is that this is a tax, like this 85 cents per month on the residential customer,
which means
is going to be applied broadly to everyone in Ohio with an electric bill. And it was instituted by the legislature. So it's a tax
and these
it's
kind
not
of
subject to referendum.
Right.
This raises all sorts of questions, because if it's a tax, that means the Public Utilities Commission can impose a tax on everyone.
That's
what does that mean?
And that changes the dynamic.
It just snowballs into all these other areas.
Exactly. I mean, when the legislature passes a tax, they say this is a tax and we're going to either decrease
it or increase
it.
And the last time they did that was I think
the
that
gas
was,
tax,
you know,
actually.
Right, I guess so. The issue here, and Ned Hill, a professor here at Ohio State University, would argue that what Jeremy just said, the PUCO approves non-bypassable riders all the time. So your utility company, the company that sends you your electric bill, goes to the PUCO and says, hey, in order to be able to carry out electricity the way that we need to charge all of our customers X amount of cents for this and X amount of cents for that. And then the PUCO approves that increase. Now, if an increased electric bill is a tax, then the PUCO has illegally been approving taxes for years now. And so that's the argument against why the bailout is not a tax.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. That's Andy Chow of Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Also with us from Cleveland.com, politics reporter Jeremy Pelzer, and state government reporter for the Cincinnati Enquirer, Jesse Ballmert. I wanted to turn to guns and gun legislation. The governor's plan is ready for its first hearing at the Ohio State House, I guess tomorrow on Tuesday. Jeremy Pelzer, what do you expect?
I expect a long, drawn-out battle and no rush to pass it. Mm-hmm. I think there, especially in the House of Representatives, there is lukewarm support for it. And in fact, to give you an idea of how they feel about it, they've also introduced recently a stand your ground bill, which, well, not directly a gun bill, basically allows—
Very controversial.
Yeah, it allows use of, changes the burden of proof in a self-defense, or I'm sorry, that's different. It allows you to, no duty to retreat before confronting an attacker.
A lot more sponsors and co-sponsors on that bill than on the governor's bill, unless I'm mistaken.
Yeah.
And the sponsors and co-sponsors of that bill sort of lay out the subgroup of people within the House that are staunchly against any sort of change to gun regulations or increase in
Whoever's
gun restrictions.
Whoever's for the Stand Your Ground bill is probably absolutely opposed to any loosening.
Right. And okay. And so you've got a couple of different pieces of legislation here. So you have the group of people who say, heck no, we do not want any more gun restrictions. In fact, we want to reduce restrictions in Ohio. And so those are basically a lot of the stand your ground people. You have other legislators who are offering some ideas as to how to sort of bolster the background check system. And that's a bill that sits in the House right now. And then you have Governor DeWine's plan, which he purposefully put into the Senate because he knew that the Senate and especially Senate Republicans are more likely to support what he's proposing right now.
And we saw this dynamic kind of play out during the budget and a variety of different topics, even House Bill 6, as we were referencing earlier. Just the appetite for legislation has been different in the Senate and the House. And so the governor thinks the Senate is a good place for this. I think it's a place where it will receive a little bit more attention. Speaking with the Speaker of the House, Larry Householder, he has problems with especially the background check changes that the governor wants to make, specifically increasing the penalty if you provide a gun to someone who should not have it because of a prior offense or something like that, and then also making it easier for prosecutors mm-hmm. to prosecute that offense by mm-hmm. kind of lowering the burden of proof. Those are things that Larry Householder thinks will basically require background checks on all gun sales. And so that's something he's not in favor of. I think the question becomes, if you in the Senate know that this piece of legislation isn't going to get much attention in the House, mm-hmm. do you take a vote on it?
Mm-hmm.
And therefore stick your neck out. Yeah.
And to back up what Jesse just said, to give you an idea of where we've come, how we've gotten to this point. So we had the mass shooting in Dayton. And then a few days later, Governor Mike DeWine laid out a plan, and it seemed to suggest expanded background checks or universal background checks and something that we know to be the red flag law, which increases the ability for the court to seize weapons. So that's 2 days after the shooting. That's what it seemed like Governor DeWine was going to do.
With Mayor Nan Whaley at his side. And
she wasn't at his side, but yeah, like she was backing him. This just days after the shooting. And then 2 months went by where the administration was crafting the actual legislation. And then when he put it out, Dayton Mayor Nan Whaley was there. But it was definitely not as restrictive as what a lot of people thought they were led to believe.
It was watered down.
So from the time of the Dayton shooting to 2 months later, it was already watered down. Now it's in the Senate, and now what's going to happen from there? I think a lot of people assume that even more will be chipped away from it.
He said that one of the main requirements for any legislation was that it was it would get enacted. And it doesn't sound like even this is going to get enacted.
He watered it down about as far as he was willing to go. And then even that's not going to be enough. He's going to have to go to bat for this pretty hard to get this passed, especially through the House.
And not to be insensitive, but what we see a lot when it comes to gun policy and when we talk about gun policy is that there's a lot of momentum behind these types of legislation right after a mass shooting, right after a tragedy. And then the further you get away from that tragedy, the less and less momentum you think those bills have.
And it's worth noting that governor's, in contrast to some of his predecessors, Governor DeWine's approach is not hard-nosed politics. He's not the type to go call lawmakers and say, do this or else. His idea is to kind of get consensus. So he's not used to, and he's not, this isn't his preferred method to kind of go to the legislature and say, hey, my way or the highway. It's an uncomfortable position for him.
And I also think we just saw Governor John Kasich try that method. I mean, he introduced a red flag bill in his final year as governor and essentially said, like, you need to do this or people will die. And, you know, perhaps that's a stance that people want Governor DeWine to do, but it obviously didn't pass the legislature either. So right. I don't know what the right legislative approach is to get them to move on a piece of legislation, but they've tried, you know, the honey and they've tried the, you know,
the
vinegar.
Carrot and the stick, the carrot and the stick. And,
yeah.
Yeah. Well, what about the signature gathering effort to get it on the ballot? Now, Dayton Mayor Nam Whaley has jumped on board with them. Is full speed ahead?
At this point, yeah. So we're talking about a citizens initiated statute from a group called Ohioans for Gun Safety. And what this would do is basically create universal background checks for some exceptions. And one of those exceptions I think should be noted is that a family member can gift a gun to another family member. So what's happening right now is this group, Ohioans for Gun Safety, is all around the state trying to collect enough signatures to be able to kick off what's known as an initiated statute, which would mean give this expanded background checks proposal to the legislature. And then the House and Senate would have 4 months to pass universal background checks, which we've seen there's not a lot of political will there. However, if they do not do that, then that group needs to go out, collect more signatures, and they could put it on the ballot as a ballot measure next November.
And we do know that the electorate, by and large, supports it. That's what the polling
time
up.
And
polling
time again
has. 9 out of 10 people support it.
Mm-hmm.
Based on any poll we see.
Now, to be clear, what this would do is right now, there already are federal background check rules for federally licensed gun dealers, which are most gun dealers, if not all gun dealers. What's at issue here are private gun sales. Like, and if I wanted me personally want to sell you a gun, that I don't have to. There's no way to prove a background check, and that's what some lawmakers are like kind of concerned about, because they're like, well, how do you enforce something like that if it's just one person selling it to another? How does the government know?
Most are gun dealers, but increasingly they're private because of the internet, right? I mean, that's
the internet. Yes. And gun shows are the other
gun
shows.
Yeah, you have online
gun show loophole, right?
Online sales and gun show sales, which are done by private transactions, and therefore you do not have to require a background check of those people. And you're right, Ann, there is a trend of more and more people going this route, basically using this as, I don't want to say a profession, but like this is a route that people can take. And without expanding background checks, you don't need to require a check on those sales.
Yeah, there is a long road to the ballot for this. As Andy pointed out, you know, it'll go to the legislature first. But if it is on the 2020 November ballot, that will be interesting because it will perhaps speak to especially suburban voters who see gun control as an issue for them, maybe even a top issue on their ballot. And more Democrats will be at the polls during a presidential year than any other year. So I think if it's something that's driving Democrats to the polls on election day, that'll be a concern for
Republicans
in the legislature.
But they got a scoot. They about as of a couple of weeks ago, they only had 20,000 signatures. They need something like 114,000 signatures, and they're really ramping up. But, you know, it's November. This isn't HB6, you know, summer of petition collecting. You know, it's getting colder. They might be in trouble. They might get it, but it's not a sure thing.
It's not prime season for collecting signatures on Bill. On those. Let's take a quick break. We'll get back to it. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's a weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us is Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Andy Chow, Cleveland.com politics reporter Jeremy Pelzer, and Cincinnati Inquirer state government reporter Jesse Ballmert. I wanted to talk about a couple things I'm afraid we're not going to get to tonight. One thing is the ban on foreign investments. We should have talked about this when we were talking about House Bill 6 earlier, but you recently wrote about how Republican House members are sponsoring a resolution to ban certain foreign investments. What is this all about?
So this would be a constitutional.
It's a resolution. Does it really have?
Well, it's a resolution to become a constitutional amendment. So it would have to go to the voters for approval. But what this would do is ban any foreign company from holding a majority stock in a company that provides critical infrastructure to Ohio. So we're talking about power plants, power lines, water treatment plants. I'm forgetting something. Gas lines. The fear here is that legislators claim that if a foreign investment or if a foreign company has majority investment in something, then they have the power to maybe pull the rug out from Ohio and make that part of the infrastructure collapse.
And so what do people say? I mean, what's the likelihood of that? It's there's foreign investment is pretty common.
On the one hand, you have, if you remember, the Huawei idea about where the federal government banned Huawei from winning contracts to install cell phone equipment
on the grounds that
on the grounds that maybe the Chinese government. So it's not unprecedented, but this is not as idealistic, perhaps. No one was talking about this before House Bill 6. No one. And they say they were privately talking about it. I didn't hear anyone talking about it. But on the same side, they are keep pushing it. And it's not just an HB6 gambit. They're actually trying to go through with this. And the obvious winners here will be the same people pushing House Bill 6, the losers would be natural gas plants.
Mm-hmm. And just to remind people, HB6 is the nuclear power plant bailout that we were talking about earlier. And like Jeremy said, nobody was really talking about this. The day HB6 passed and then we all gathered around House Speaker Larry Householder was the first time I think I ever heard him say anything about this. And it was like kind of a huge surprise. Like, what are you talking about? Foreign investment having – and so then it was slowly revealed that, oh, they're talking about natural gas plants. The fear here, again, to sort of give the side of people who support this measure, Representative Jamie Callender, a Republican who's sponsoring this resolution, laid out this idea of natural gas makes up, I think, more than 30% of Ohio's energy grid. I think maybe even more than that. And so what he's saying is when we become over-reliant on a power energy source of which most of its investment comes from a foreign company, and if that foreign company happens to be China, then he thinks it's a threat to Ohio's energy grid and to Ohio's infrastructure, because he says that maybe the Chinese company can say, hey, turn off that natural gas plant. There are more barriers in place to stop something like that from happening, but that's sort of like the nightmare scenario that supporters of this resolution are putting out there.
Is anyone concerned about discouraging foreign investment in the state of Ohio?
Yeah, I think that's a concern. And I think obviously foreign investment, I think maybe that's even something the governor brought up when he was asked about this proposal. Obviously, we have a whole Jobs Ohio system encouraging investment from all manner of people into the state. And so, yeah, that's obviously a concern. I imagine business groups would start voicing their opinions on this.
Does the governor need to sign in a resolution like this?
I don't think so. No. I think it bypasses the governor.
Okay.
Yeah. And so the governor, when asked about it, he said, listen, I just went on a trip to Japan to make some deals and try to make good relationships there. When he was asked, Lieutenant Governor John Husted was about to get onto a plane to go to London. Ohio and the DeWine administration, they want foreign investment. They say it's key to the economy for foreign companies to invest in Ohio.
Yeah, because this isn't just China. It's Canada.
Mm-hmm.
It's Australia. It's Australia. It's every foreign country.
Right.
And I will point out just one other safeguard that it exists. The federal government can block projects if the investment poses a national security risk. And this is something both the Obama and the Trump administration has done. They have kind of a review of, is this going to be a problem for our infrastructure or just industry? And so there are some safeguards in place at the federal level.
And I think something that is important to point out, too, is that right now the way the constitutional amendment is written is if it were to pass, then the companies that do have a majority holding from foreign companies, those foreign companies would have a year to divest, to take their money out of that company, which would be a huge blow to a lot of existing companies in Ohio.
Switching gears, the number of uninsured children in Ohio increased 28%.
28% to, I believe the number is 133,000 children in Ohio.
What in the world? I mean, what's going on?
Well, so the day after the report came out, I talked to Governor Mike DeWine about it, and he said he was immediately going to go to his cabinet to ask every member of his cabinet and within his administration about what's going on, what they need to do to address it. So as far as Ohio's the DeWine administration line is, we don't know what's happening right now, and we're going to look into it. The researchers of the report cited different policy changes from Congress and through the White House and sort of the rhetoric behind changing healthcare issues that are just creating barriers towards people getting health insurance. And so if you were to look at things like creating these waivers to create work requirements, requiring somebody to work, that's just another form of paper they have to
fill
out.
For Medicaid.
For Medicaid. Adding different paperwork, adding different things, that hoops that people have to jump through to get it, means that people fall through the cracks and end up going uninsured. And this study found that the people who also end up hurting there are the children.
Do they know if this is something that's going to continue to increase?
They believe that. So more than 15 states saw a large, notable percentage increase in the amount of uninsured children within their state, Texas, Florida, Georgia. And so the authors of the report seem to suggest that this is something that's going to continue to happen, that this is some sort of leak happening somewhere within policy that needs to be plugged, or it'll just continue to happen.
And, of course, this is all hands on deck for Governor DeWine, who's made helping kids a number one priority of his administration. So, you know, when he hears this is right in his wheelhouse.
This is anecdotal. This was not something that's been proven. But you've heard other policymakers more along Democratic lines suggesting that also the rhetoric against immigration and the crackdown on immigration and undocumented workers could maybe playing a role as well, where if maybe you're here and you're undocumented, you decide that you don't file the paperwork for this coverage or that coverage, and then all of a sudden you also fall through the cracks and then your children go uninsured.
Another issue, the abortion reversal pill bill is supposed to get could be on the floor. is this in the House? And
it's in the Senate.
In the Senate? What are the expectations?
There's a couple bills in the Senate that are up for committee votes this week or possible committee votes this week. And so could be on the floor as soon as this week. I don't know if that's the plan. But
this reversal pill is not – it's the opponents are calling it fake science. It's
yeah, there's been some research that this doesn't – work, and the research that it does work is very scant. There's like a couple references to sometimes opinion and letters together kind of to medical journals.
Well,
and
so, why are they spending so much time on something like this? Do they have an explanation?
If you were to ask the bill sponsor, Senator Peggy Lehner, and she says that there are reports out there, but, you know, which have been disputed by other medical professionals. But at this point, this is a legislature that is set on continuing to create regulations around abortion. And this is just could be just another example of that. So the issue here is that a medically induced abortion requires, I believe, two pills. And so what this bill would do is force doctors to provide the information that if a pregnant person takes that first pill, they need to be made aware of the fact that of the idea that an abortion could be reversed if they go through a different procedure. And again, that procedure has not been backed by most of the medical community.
And I think it's mostly, I mean, we passed the heartbeat bill or the 6-week gestational ban earlier this year, which was really, you know, one of the nation's most restrictive abortion bans. Mm-hmm. And so, like, now we're just kind of eating at the edges of abortion restrictions. It seems like we have things like this. We have things like
John Becker's bill.
Yeah, there's a variety of them out there. I think we still have like the cremation or burial bill out there. So there's
where remains of abortions would have to receive a burial.
Right.
So but you're right. So that's something that is slated for a possible committee vote tomorrow, and it could be on the floor as early as this week.
Okay. Governor DeWine also has ordered a review of Ohio's parole system. This was after a parolee was indicted for murder. Jeremy Pelzer, you wrote about this proposed reexamination of parole policies. What's the problem?
Yeah, this came after a just shocking story in Dayton where this guy was paroled, and then his dad apparently was driving him to get mental health treatment. He stabbed his dad, and then took the car. He crashed his car. Officers responded. He stole a police car. And then he got into an accident that killed two young girls. And so in response to this, Governor DeWine's ordered a pretty comprehensive review of all the different aspects of the parole board for, you know, everything from how parole standards are set to what the whole process. And as Governor DeWine usually does, he set up a blue ribbon panel to take a look at this, and then he'll get recommendations and move forward.
A lot of complaints about the parole system have to do with the old law versus the new law, right? Do you know about that?
The old law versus the
new law of parole.
Oh, yeah. I see what you're saying. Yeah. These older inmates are treated separately, but that's one thing that they're probably going to look at, too. That would require a legislative – most of these would require legislative changes. So even if the governor has this, it's another thing he'll have to go to lawmakers about.
And this call from the governor is coming after several reports of people arguing that the parole system is broken for people who might need to be offered parole and who don't get it. So this is interesting that this is somebody who got parole that clearly maybe shouldn't have – been let out. The argument for the other side, for the people who maybe should receive parole, is that there are some who believe that the system right now is sort of arbitrary, where it's basically you will not be let out after your first hearing. This is a lot of people around the state, a lot of state leaders have been calling for a review of the process to really look into how to make this more effective.
How's the parole board responding to this?
Well, keep in mind, the parole board's already come under fire by Governor mm-hmm. DeWine because early last year, one of the members who quit, Shirley Smith, said there were a number of problems, like parole board members were eating lunch during hearings. They heard some discriminatory comments, mm-hmm. things like that. And so Governor DeWine came in, and then his new state prisons chief, they came in to kind of clean house, and this is through that. The parole board, it's hard for reporters like us to get a hold of them because for obvious reasons, their name is not in the phone book. And so they usually issue a statement through the state prisons agency instead of going out and talking to reporters. So that's a long way of saying we don't fully know what the individual parole board members think about this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it seems like for this particular Dayton situation, they had decided that this was an appropriate use of parole. And so that's where the governor is saying, like, well, if this is following our current protocols, are these protocols correct mm-hmm. that this person was able to get out? Another issue is they have something like 490 parole officers supervising 37,000 Ohioans. And so
it's like the social services system.
So is that tenable? It doesn't seem like it from the numbers. But how do you resolve that situation?
Andy, you know, Marie Energy, one of the nation's largest producers of coal, mm-hmm. Notably from Ohio, has filed for bankruptcy. What are the implications from this? What does it matter?
Well, this is a big this is a big signal of a continuing trend of coal companies, coal producers, and coal plants just going out of business or filing for bankruptcy. What people might want to know about Bob Murray is that he has been a very vocal opponent to President Barack Obama for years. If you could point to somebody who coined the term war on coal, it might have been Bob Murray. He echoed that term all the time, saying that Barack Obama was the person who was killing the coal industry, when in reality, the free market was killing the coal industry. And
AKA natural gas.
Natural gas and the development of renewable energy mm-hmm. power sources. And so what we see here is that not only does this could mean a lot of things for these coal mines. I mean, this is 40 million tons of coal come out of these mines every year, and they're shipped to Ohio coal plants and other coal plants around the country. This could be the end of this could be the result of a lot of coal mines closing and a lot of coal miners put out of
work. And also there's a question about reclamation of old coal mines.
Yes.
And whether that would go forward.
Well, because the state has a reclamation forfeiture fund to do this, and there's every ton of coal is taxed and it goes into this fund. The fund has about $22 million in it. If Murray Energy completely goes under and you have to close all these mine locations in Ohio, they have about a dozen, I think, it would cost an estimated $202 million. And so the other $180 million would have to come from taxpayers, from mm-hmm. the General Revenue Fund. Now, that keep in mind, that has not happened yet. There's no sign that they're going to close these, but it's raised a lot of people's attention. It's like, oh, well, if this keeps going the way it's going, the taxpayers might be on the hook for a lot of this. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I haven't heard any lawmakers talk about this. It's kind of early.
And none of these coal mines are among the two that are going to get bailed out by way of House Bill 6.
Not power plants.
Coal power plants. Right, mm-hmm. right. Gotcha.
Right. So not directly, but when a coal plant goes out of business, then that's a revenue source that's instantly closed to the coal mines. And that's been part of the problem, is that the economics of it all is, yes, HB6 helped coal mining and coal producing like Murray, because it kept the Samus plant open under First Energy Solutions and it keeps the two OVEC plants running. But apparently it wasn't enough because they filed for bankruptcy.
It's just interesting. Murray is a pretty well politically connected fellow. He held a fundraiser earlier this year for President Trump that both Governor DeWine and Speaker Householder attended. So that's just
well, I know. I think it's very important to point out that when you see President Donald Trump in a hard hat with the coal miners and saying that he's going to save coal, that was, I believe, at a Murray Energy site. So this could have big implications. President Trump came in saying that he was going to save coal, and we've seen, I think, 8 different coal companies file for bankruptcy this year.
One other wrinkle, going back to House Bill 6, speaking of those coal plants, is there's an argument being made that they screwed up the language of the bill that they passed. Like, they drafted this bill really kind of at the last second, and then there were a lot of cooks in the kitchen. And the way the bill was worded, some people say, well, for these two coal plants, it, long story short, they wrote it that they have to be eligible for this federal under the had to be approved by this federal commission. Long story short, they have not been approved by this federal commission. So there's an argument being made that the way they wrote the bill, it actually bans subsidies to the coal plants they were intended to help. So that's another issue, too.
That's all the time we have for today. I want to thank you, Jeremy Pelzer of Cleveland.com, for joining us.
Thank you.
And Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
And Jesse Ballmert, state government reporter for the Cincinnati Enquirer, thanks to you as well.
Always a fun time.
Thanks, everybody else, for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.